I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, we have freelance writer Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, syndicated columnist Ruben Navarrete, and NPR's political editor Ken Rudin. Jimmy, take it away.
J-Lu, what's up?
How are you?
Thank you so... I'm good, good. It's good to have you back in the shop.
Thanks.
Fellas, welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
Hey, hey, hey.
Good, man. Great.
Well, you know, Jimmy, let me tell you, it's the first barbershop without Senator Edward Kennedy in the U.S. Senate.
It's a rough week, man. Senator Ted Kennedy died this week, and he leaves behind this incredible legacy. You know, and I wrote about it for TheRoot.com in this piece I wrote called Brother Kennedy, Good White Folk. And the Kennedys in general, in my opinion, because I'm not the spokesman for all black people this week, the Kennedys showed a lot of black people, frankly, that whites weren't not inherently bad and could be partners in helping to create a better, prosperous America for everybody. You know, and in my opinion, Ted was the last great true liberal. I mean, he was very altruistic. He wasn't working toward political gain, but seemed to be working for the good of all mankind. What do you think?
One thing I noticed about this completely is that once Ted Kennedy realized he was not going to be president, once the carousing stopped, once the imperfections in his personality disappeared, he became a lawmaker's lawmaker and became one of the giants of the U.S. Senate.
But Ken, I got to ask you, will his legacy be able to withstand the unanswered questions around the Chappaquiddick incident that happened on July 18, 1969, where he left Mary Jo Kopechne to drown at the scene of an accident?
Well, it's been part of his legacy ever since. Perhaps he would have been president by now. The accident was in 1969, as you say. The Democrats still wanted him to run for president. In 72, he said no. In 76, he said no. When he finally ran in 1980 against a fellow Democrat, Jimmy Carter, Chappaquiddick came up again. Chappaquiddick was always part of his life. He never defended it. He said it was indefensible. The point is that with all of us, we have made mistakes. We have done good. We have done bad in our lives. I think when you judge Ted Kennedy, when somebody judges Ted Kennedy, the enormity, the entirety of his career, it would be far more good, but that asterisk of Chappaquiddick will always be there.
President Obama is one of many who have come out to eulogize the senator. Let's just tell people that the funeral is tomorrow. Senator Kennedy was 77 years old. He died after a year fight with brain cancer. And here are some of the words President Obama had to say when news broke of his passing on Wednesday.
While these months have no doubt been difficult for him, they've also let him hear from people in every corner of our nation and from around the world just how much he meant to all of us. His fight has given us the opportunity we were denied when his brothers John and Robert were taken from us. The blessing of time to say thank you and goodbye.
Arsalan.
All right.
Well, you know, Jennifer, something that's interesting to me. I mean, I wasn't born when Chappaquiddick happened. And so, you know, to me, when I look at the totality of Ted Kennedy's life, I look at his legislative work. And, you know, you look in 1971... You know, he established a federal cancer research program that quadrupled the amount of money spent fighting cancer. He helped pass Title IX, which in 1972, which called for the NCAA to give equal funding to both women and men's sports. He actually was successful in spearheading the override of President Reagan's apartheid sanctions veto in 1986.
Stopping Robert Bork.
Right. Family Medical Leave Act in 1990. And over the objections of some of his own fellow Democrats, helping to pass No Child Left Behind in 2001. And so, you know, not only was Ted Kennedy a liberal lion in the Senate, he was also somebody who could successfully straddle the velvet rope and reach across party lines to help pass very, very important legislation that not only affected his constituents, but affected all Americans of all different stripes.
Ruben, the R, who's gonna inherit his mantle of leadership, bro?
You know, you got to take that question in two pieces. The mantle of leadership in the Kennedy household and the Kennedy family and the popular imagination with the Kennedys. And secondly, with the Senate, let's do the Senate first. It's easy. I think that you will find people to step up to the plate. People like Chuck Schumer in New York, who's already come up to take hold of one of Senator Kennedy's big issues. That's immigration reform. And so Schumer stepped up to that. I think you will find some truth to what John McCain said fondly about Senator Kennedy, that he was as close to irreplaceable as you get in the Senate. The other void, though, in the family is much harder to fill. I don't think you're going to be able to fill that, because you see now this other generation sort of fading from memory. You have all four of the brothers gone. And now you have what's left over. You have the Kennedy grandchildren. And with a couple of exceptions, people like Rory Kennedy, who's a documentary filmmaker, and Citizen Energy's Joe Kennedy, and you know Robert Kennedy Jr., who's a noted environmentalist, you still have a lot of Kennedy folk out there, a lot of Kennedy grandkids who just aren't worth the plug nickel, because they really embody what's wrong with a family where everything is given to kids, where they don't necessarily produce, that they've had to deal with divorces and drug problems and drug addictions. It's just been a real downhill slope, I think, for this next generation of Kennedy kids.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and we're in the barbershop speaking with journalists Jimmy Israel, Arsalan Iftikhar, Ken Rudin, and Ruben Navarrete. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm sure I can speak for all the fellas in the shop and say that we want to extend our condolences to the Kennedy family at this rough time.
Right on.
So the Obamas, they're chilling out at Martha's Vineyard, which is, I hear, because you know I'm not one of the hoity-toities.
You're not there.
I hear it's a tradition among well-heeled Black Americans, and there are various opinions about the first family's vacation. Ruben, what? Obama can't take a rest? He doesn't deserve a little R&R? What's good?
Well, listen, I think it's a bum rap. I think that the president, you know, has a right to take a vacation just like every other president. Clearly, you'd have to take a lot of vacations to equal what President Bush 41 and 43 did in terms of vacations. And certainly right. Bill Clinton was always out there whenever things got hot, which was often in the Clinton household. There was a vacation in the offing. I'm more troubled, though, Jimmy, by this ugly charge of elitism that somehow Black folks can't vacation on Martha's Vineyard. When I've read stuff about that from some really clueless columnists and bloggers out there who aren't aware that Black folks have, in fact, been vacationing on Martha's Vineyard for a long, long time. And so I think that we have this narrow, stifling perception of what is appropriate behavior for our first Black president. And this is another example where even some well-meaning liberals come forward and really wonder if he belongs in Martha's Vineyard. And I say, hell yes, he does.
I would feel much more comfortable. I would feel much more comfortable, though, if he were clearing brush. Because to me, on Martha's Vineyard, because that's what president should be doing.
Is there brush on Martha's Vineyard?
Where is he supposed to be doing holiday? In Detroit? You know, the conservatives don't like this.
Right on.
The conservatives don't like this. And they put out a little piece of tape. Isn't that right, Jay?
They certainly did. You knew it was coming. This ad is called Surf's Up, and it was released this week by the nonprofit organization Conservatives for Patients' Rights.
The beach is nice this time of year, but while President Obama vacations, concerns mount about his health care plan. Why? Because his public option health plan could lead to government-run health care, higher taxes on everything from paychecks to soda, and add $1 trillion to the deficit. Mr. President, when you go back to D.C., drop your government-run public option plan. Let's get on with real reform to lower cost and protect patients' rights.
Wow. Thanks for that, Jennifer. You know what I think, A-Train? I think people see a Black man in the White House, and they expect that he should work as hard as humanly possible to get whatever has to be done. Look, he's there, and he doesn't deserve a vacation. He should just work it out.
Presidents are human beings just like anyone else, and especially when you have the weight of our current economy, you know, the healthcare reform debate. I mean, I would probably try to take more vacation days.
But Arsalan, shouldn't
go ahead, Ken.
Shouldn't the president be, while he's on vacation? I mean, people are killing my grandparents. This new healthcare.
I'm the death panel, right?
They're killing my grandparents.
I'm the death panel.
Exactly. Right. Now, I mean, something should be done about this.
Okay. So, in other news, pop star Michael Jackson's death ruled a homicide. You know, but his doctor, Conrad Murray, has yet to be charged. Authorities believe Dr. Murray gave Michael Jackson, quote-unquote, lethal levels of a powerful anesthetic called propofol as a sleep aid. Wow. We got some tape, yes?
We do. We have the first public remarks since Michael Jackson died on June 25th. These are the first remarks from his doctor, Conrad Murray, who is the subject of the death investigation here. He actually released a video last week on YouTube explaining to family and friends that he has been afraid to answer emails and phone calls, but telling them that he's done nothing wrong.
Your messages give me strength and courage. They mean the world to me. Please, don't worry. As long as I keep God in my heart and you in my life, I will be fine. I have done all I could do. I told the truth, and I have faith the truth will prevail.
Wow, that sounds like a Michael Jackson lyric. Is that just me? I mean, that sounds like throwaway lyrics right. from Man in the Mirror or something. It's really sad that Dr. Murray can't confront what very well may be the truth, that as much as he wanted to help and service his client, Arsalan, that he may in fact have contributed to his death. Should he be charged with MJ's death?
I don't think so.
What?
I'll break that down for you in a second.
After sure.
Hearing that audio clip, you know, I'm not sure if he went to the Bobby McFerrin School of Medicine, but you know, when you look in the legal
don't worry.
The term homicide in any legal dictionary is the killing of one human being by the act or omission of another human being, and so criminal homicide is when a person purposefully, knowingly, recklessly, and or with extreme negligence causes the death of another. And so murder and manslaughter are examples of criminal homicide. Now, this is going to hinge on negligence. Now, you know, there are newspaper reports that said that, you know, Michael Jackson referred to propofol as his milk. So, you know.
And asked
nice.
For it.
Right.
Nice.
And so.
Nice.
You know, I don't know if the requisite intent for Dr. Conrad Murray is going to be there in a legal court of law. Now, I think that, you know, there are people who are, you know, out for blood, so to speak, in terms of, you know, wanting someone to be responsible for MJ's death. But I think at the end of the day, at being the lawyer in the barbershop, I really don't see, you know, I mean, I could see his medical license being revoked and things like that. But
you know what, though, A-Train? Can I just push back on that a little bit? Well, see, the piece of that's the problem is that propofol is mad serious. I mean, because, you know, even people that use it in the hospitals, that there has to be – they use it during surgery, and there has to be somebody in the room that knows how to do CPR because people tend to stop breathing when on propofol. So this doctor, knowing this, we hope, because he got his PhD – you know,
his MD.
Right. Bobby McFerrin School of Medicine.
Yeah, his MD. Thank you.
And to be fair, he wanted to contact his medical school later, but apparently he had thrown the matchbook away. So.
Right. He knew this. And he also gave Michael Jackson, before he gave him the propofol, a whole grocery list of other drugs. Ken Dog,
to be honest with you, the only reason I've been staying out of this conversation is since 1983, I've been abusing Mylanta. And so I feel like
good luck with that.
Okay. Moving right along.
Quickly, please.
Yes. Microsoft this week apologized for swapping a black model for a white model in one of their online ads. Now, the ad features three business people, one Asian, one black, and one white, but one of the models was altered for Microsoft's website in Poland. Now, some people on the internet say that it's just target marketing. Other people just say it's racist. But I wonder if we're just being a little naive because, you know, back in the day, in order to sell certain products like Percy Sledge, for instance, on the cover of Percy Sledge's records, there were very often white families, white couples, you know, and on the back of the record, there were this small picture of Percy Sledge, you know, and businesses aren't really in the business of social change. They're in the business to make money. It's like when Colgate bought Hazel and Harley Chemical Company back in 1995, they inherited this product called Darkey Toothpaste. Now, on the cover of the toothpaste, there's this Sambo with this top hat and with a big, you know, black face grin. Now, they renamed it Darley only after a whole bunch of protests from civil rights groups. You know, so, right, I know, right? But at the end of the day...
The things you learn in the shop.
Right. I wonder as Americans if we're naive about the way... you know, target marketing works overseas,
you know,
in other markets. Go ahead, A-Train.
Jimmy, I think what you're saying is a good point, except for the fact, and you know, some people are saying that, you know, they removed the black model because of, you know, the racially homogenous, you know, Polish.
Right, it's Poland.
Well, no, but the one thing that I think you're missing is they kept the Asian guy in the ad right next to him, and I don't know if there are that many Asians, if they're, you know, less blacks in Poland than than Asians. So I would say I would agree with you if it was across the board, if they changed, you know, everybody of color to what fit white people, but to sort of Photoshop the person in the middle, but still keep an ethnic Asian guy on the left, I think was a major gaffe.
But there is good news, though. There is good news. The black guy who was became a white guy, a cab stopped to pick him up. And so that's good news.
Can I say, I just think Microsoft was being cheap. I mean, for crying out loud, it was an internet ad. You can't just take another picture. You know, if you're going to go, fine, have some Polish-looking people in your ad for Poland. Why try to, you know, and then do it to do it badly and only Photoshop half the guy's body? It's just cheap.
It's no big.
Ruben, wrap it up for us, please.
It's no big deal. I mean, Microsoft has been quoted in this story as saying, you know, we're getting to get to the bottom of this. We're not sure how this happened.
Yeah,
at that
right.
point, they're just sort of making too much out of it. They probably know how it happened. If they want to do business in Poland, fine. If they want to take a hit, you know, from people who are outraged, that's fine too. But I wouldn't put them in the PC penalty box for this. I got bigger fish to fry right now.
Right. Yeah, seriously. You know, if they want to create some kind of ad gremlin that defaced their ad, they have no idea how this happened. That's whatever, man. Just get Windows Vista to work for me, please. You know, so, and with that, ladies and gentlemen, we got to call it a wrap. Thank you so much for coming out to the shop. And I have to throw it to the lady of the house.
Thank you,
Jennifer.
Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist who writes for TheRoot.com. He's also a presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and he joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Ruben Navarrete, a syndicated columnist. He is frequently featured on CNN.com, and he joined us from member station KOGO in San Diego. And here with me in our Washington studios, Ursulan Iftikhar, the founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and a civil rights attorney, and Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor. Thanks all so much. It was fun.
Peace.
Two words, my Lanta.
Take care.
Yep.
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bracton Booker, Monica Estatieva, Jasmine Garst, Irva Gunja, Lee Hill, Douglas Hopper, Arjun Hutchins, Jennifer Longmire, and Enrique Rivera. Our planning editor is Luis Clemens. Our line editor is Alicia Montgomery. The program's directed by Rob Sachs. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones, with assistance from Neil Tivot. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment, with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. And the supervising senior producer is Tashima Walker. I'm Jennifer Ludden. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Michelle Martin returns on Monday.